Okay, imagine waking up, the sun's just hitting American soil. Where does your mind go? Maybe the Statue of Liberty, Florida beaches.
Yeah, the East Coast, probably.
Exactly. But what if I told you the very first light, the real start of America's day, isn't there at all?
You're talking about the Pacific.
Way out in the Pacific. It falls on this small island, Guam. It's actually a full 15 hours ahead of Eastern time here in North America.
It's quite a thought, isn't it? America's Day is starting on this island. An island that, let's be honest, many people don't think about much or maybe misunderstand. So that's what our deep dive is all about today, Guam. It's been a U.S. territory since, what, 1898? We're going to dig into its really unique status, its history, which is pretty rich and often turbulent, and its huge strategic importance for the U.S. military. And crucially, this kind of paradox.
The central irony, really.
Exactly, this vibrant, very patriotic place, deeply tied to the U.S., hugely important, and yet that often feels, well, forgotten or overlooked.
That's the puzzle, isn't it? How can America's Day literally begin in a place where the people are U.S. nationals, but they don't have full federal representation? No presidential vote, a non-voting member in the House.
It's a critical piece of America's global presence, but politically kind of invisible in some ways.
So let's zoom in a bit. Geographically, where exactly is it?
Okay.
So it's part of the Mariana Islands chain, but it's important to note it's a separate U.S. territory from the Northern Mariana Islands. They're distinct entities.
And it's small, right? Like really small.
Oh, tiny. We're talking, what, maybe 58 kilometers long and maybe 19 kilometers at its widest. The
Wow.
whole area is just 217 square miles. I mean, put that in perspective. Rhode Island, our smallest state, is over 1,500 square miles.
That's a huge difference. And yet, this tiny place gets its own time zone, the Chamorro time zone.
It does. And interestingly, that time zone was actually defined by the U.S. Congress.
Which brings us right back to that representation issue, doesn't it? A Congress they don't fully participate in decides their time zone. Precisely. The people of Guam, they are U.S. citizens. They get U.S. protection, security, defense, all of that. But similar to Puerto Rico, they don't get a voting say in the federal government. No vote for president, just that non-voting representative in the House.
So this term non-incorporated territory, it sounds technical, but what does it really mean for people living there?
Well, basically, it means fundamental rights apply, freedom of speech, things like that. They're guaranteed by law. But other constitutional rights, like crucially, the right to vote in federal elections, those aren't automatically available. It creates this, well, almost a tiered system of citizenship.
A pretty significant difference in how your citizenship works compared to someone in the 50 states. How did this whole arrangement even come about? What's the history here?
Well, to really get it, you have to go way back. The island's indigenous people, the Chamorros, settled there first around 4,000 years ago.
4,000 years.
Yeah, deep roots. And today's population reflects that complex history. You see a mix of Micronesian, Spanish, and Filipino heritage.
So a long history before outsiders, but then inevitably.
Exactly. Larger powers arrived. The Spanish conquest started way back in 1521. Ferdinand Magellan
Oh,
landed
that's
there,
Helen. Okay.
and that kicked off 300 years of Spanish rule. That ended in 1898 after the Spanish-American War. Spain lost, and Guam was ceded to the United States.
Right, along with Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. That was all part of the Treaty of Paris.
That's the one. And control then passed to the U.S. Navy.
But the story takes a really dark turn during World War II, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Just 2 days after Pearl Harbor, Japan invaded Guam.
2 days. Wow.
Yeah. And that began this really brutal occupation that lasted almost 3 years. About 1,000 people were killed during that time. It's a deeply traumatic part of their history.
You can only imagine, on such a small island, that loss. It must have been devastating.
Absolutely. But then emerging from that conflict, Guam took on this completely new, really pivotal role for the U.S. military.
Almost like that wartime experience cemented its future strategic value.
You could definitely see it that way. The U.S. built an air base right after retaking the island in 1944. And that military footprint has just grown massively since then.
How big are we talking today?
Well, currently there are about 6,000 U.S. military personnel stationed there. But that number is set to basically double.
Double.
Yeah, they're relocating 5,000 Marines from Okinawa, starting, well, that process began around 2022.
So that's a huge presence on a small island. What does that look like on the ground?
It means the U.S. military controls about a third of the island's land.
A third. including vital resources like water.
Including its largest sources of fresh water, yeah. And this military presence drives something like 30% of Guam's entire economy.
That's huge. And what kind of facilities are we talking about?
Major ones. You've got Anderson Air Force Base, Naval Base Guam, the overall Joint Region Marianas Command.
Okay.
It also hosts this enormous testing and live fire training range, nearly 1 million square miles.
1 million square miles? That's vast.
It is. Plus, there's a Naval Ordnance Annex, a big telecommunications station, a Naval Computer Center, and importantly, a THAAD missile defense battery.
The AAD, right, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense.
Exactly. And it's home base for 4 nuclear-powered fast attack submarines, a couple of submarine tenders, B-52 bombers, fighter jets. It's packed with capability.
It really paints a picture of just how strategically vital it is. I mean, thinking back, it was the main launch pad for the Vietnam War, wasn't it?
It was. And also a key point for evacuating Vietnamese refugees afterwards.
Right.
And today, its location gives the U.S. easy access to potential lot spots like the Koreas, the Taiwan Strait, and it maintains a really critical presence near the South China Sea.
No wonder you hear military commanders call it things like the permanent aircraft carrier.
Yeah, or important strategic hub, farthest west U.S. territory. It underscores its geographic and military significance.
Given all that, it probably makes sense that there's a strong military culture on the island itself.
Oh, absolutely. It's deeply ingrained. If you actually compare enlistment rates, Guam has the highest rate of military enlistment compared to any of the 50 states.
The highest? Really?
The highest. Military service is often a multi-generational thing there. You see families where parents, kids, cousins all serve.
Wow.
In fact, 1 in 8 residents is a military veteran.
1 in 8. That's incredible patriotism and connection to the U.S. But then I read somewhere that Guam comes last in spending for veteran medical care. Is that right?
That is, unfortunately, often cited. And it's a stark contrast, isn't it?
It feels like a real disconnect. Such high service rates, such patriotism, and then that statistic, it touches on that forgotten feeling again, perhaps.
It certainly feeds into that narrative, that irony we keep coming back to. You see this pride, though. The biggest celebration on Guam every year is Liberation Day, July 21st.
Liberation Day.
Yeah, it commemorates the return of U.S. troops, the end of the Japanese occupation. There's a huge parade on Marine Corps Drive in the Capitol, Hagonya, memorials, services. It's a profoundly American celebration.
So you have this intense patriotism, this vital strategic role, side by side with this complicated political status. Let's circle back to that non-incorporated territory definition.
Right. So, as we said, fundamental rights apply, but other constitutional rights don't. And that lack of voting representation in the Congress that decides things like its time zone, it's pretty striking.
And this isn't just an internal U.S. discussion, is it? The U.N. has weighed in.
It has. The United Nations actually lists Guam as one of 17 remaining non-self-governing territories in the world.
17 globally. Okay.
And under the U.N. Charter, which the U.S. is a signatory to, these territories are supposed to be, well, decolonized.
Decolonized. What does that mean in practice?
It means they should have the right to self-determination, to choose their future political status. Mm. The UN has been pushing for this since the 90s, calling on administering powers like the U.S. to help facilitate that. There's even been a third international decade for the eradication of colonialism.
So the U.S. has sort of agreed in principle by signing the charter, but there's no actual timeline.
Essentially, yes. There's agreement on the principle of self-determination, but no set path or deadline for Guam.
Have there been specific ideas floated for how Guam could get, say, greater rights within the current system or move towards self-determination?
There have been discussions. One idea that comes up is a potential constitutional amendment, similar to the 23rd Amendment that gave Washington, D.C. residents the presidential vote. Maybe something like that for all U.S. territories, including Guam.
Hmm. Interesting.
And locally, the government of Guam has actually set up a commission on decolonization. They're using federal grant money right now for education and registering eligible voters for an eventual plebiscite on status.
It's really important to stress, though, this push for decolonization or self-determination. It's not necessarily anti-American, right?
Not at all. That's a crucial point. It's generally framed as a push for the chance to choose, to exercise self-determination, to have agency over their own future. It's not necessarily about severing ties.
That makes sense. It's about wanting a say. So we end up back at this core paradox. Whatever happens politically, Guam is American right now, legally, historically, culturally, especially with that deep military connection.
Undeniably.
But the irony is just so stark. The very first place the American Day dawns often seems to be the last place considered when it comes to full political rights, civil rights, even practical support sometimes.
Yeah, we've really covered a lot of ground today, haven't we? From those ancient Chamorro roots through Spanish rule, the trauma of World War II, to becoming this vital U.S. military hub, all while navigating this unique and complex political status.
It shows how America's Day begins there, literally. But the understanding of Guam's place within America, that seems much less clear for many people.
That contradiction is really at the heart of it.
So it leaves you thinking, doesn't it? What does it really mean for a place to be American when its people serve, contribute, identify as American, but lack that full federal representation, that right to self-determination? As that sun keeps rising first on Guam day after day, maybe the question for us is, what responsibility do we have to better understand this often forgotten part of the American story and what its people hope for their future?